Perhaps more than any other term, Reconquista, or Reconquest, is deeply embedded in the historiography of medieval Spain. Closely connected to Spanish nationalist movements in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and embedded in many of the ways that Spanish communities memorialize the past even today, Reconquista has stood in as the unifying event of medieval Spanish history. More recently, however, historians have begun to question the use of this term in exploring the period from the Visigoths to the early 16th century, highlighting in particular how it essentializes what is a very complex history. Today I speak with Dr. Miriam Shattis about the concept of Reconquista, where it came from, and why medieval Spanish historians are challenging its use in the history they write. Dr. Shattis is an associate professor in the history department at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, where she teaches courses on medieval Spain, the Crusades, medieval women, and food and drink in the pre-modern West, among other things. She is the author of Berengula of Castile, 1180 to 1246, and Political Women in the High Middle Ages, and a number of essays on elite women in medieval France, Castile, and Portugal. Most recently, she is the author of Founders, Sisters, and Neighbors in the 13th Century, Women and Community at the Santa Maria de Celes Coimbra, in Women and Community in Medieval and Early Modern Iberia, edited by Michelle Armstrong Partida, Allison Garrison, and myself, Dana Wessel Lightfoot. She is currently working on one study of the early queens of Portugal from 1100 to 1250, and another on the Queens of Leon from 1126 to 1230. Thank you again, Miriam, for taking the time today to talk about the concept of Reconquista with us. I really appreciate it because I know it's the summer, first of all, but also I think this is a really important term in thinking about the historiography of medieval Spain.
You're welcome, Dana. I'm glad to be here. I have to tell you that it's not spring-like or summer-like at all here in Athens, Ohio right now. It's chilly today. And I'm super excited to talk about the Reconquista as a concept, the problem of reconquest, and the way it shapes the way we think about medieval Spain.
So before we think about how historians are now challenging this term, which has really been a part of medieval Spanish history for a long time, we need to start with a definition. So what does Reconquista mean? Let me start with that one.
I think the simple way to explain it is just to translate it, right? So reconquest, taking back. Everybody can understand what a conquest is or a conqueror is. And when we think about reconquest, we think about a phenomenon where people are taking back something that was taken from them. That's a straightforward translation, maybe, of the term. And then for Spain, specifically medieval Spain, when you think about the Reconquista, it's referring to a period of time starting in the middle of the 8th century and lasting all the way through to the very end of the 15th century. And actually, even this is a term that gets used to talk about in a weird sort of way. Talk about the Spanish colonialism in the New World, right? The figure of the conquistador, the conqueror. Yeah. And so I think Reconquista refers to narrative of this medieval period, where it's implying that the whole period is characterized by this taking back and this reconquering of things. We're going to talk more about the implications of all this, but it definitely has a sense from one perspective, a sense of progress, right? That we're moving forward in time and we are reclaiming something, whoever we are that we are studying, that they are reclaiming something that belonged to them. And that's the big motor of the history of medieval Iberia.
And so the idea that when the Muslims invaded in the early 8th century and conquered the Visigoths, that the people that were the Visigoths were pushed up to the northern part of the peninsula and then gradually over hundreds and hundreds of years, those same people then attempted to reconquer this territory from the Muslims. Right. That's the implication of it?
I think so. And it's a really important point to emphasize that the Christians who eventually expanded their power, right, back over the peninsula, there's a shape to who's in power, right? And I'm sure you're looking at maps in your class. You can look at how Iberia looks like it's all covered in one green color because that's Al-Andalus. And then over time, Christian kingdoms expand themselves. There's this idea that these are all the same people and that they have a lineage and that lineage is part of what legitimates their action. And they've all had the same ambition, which is to take back something that belonged to them in the past, and the same motivations. And that's very convenient. It's a very convenient way, an easy way to understand things, but it's not correct. It's misleading, in fact. I think the other thing I should say about the Reconquista as we understand it in terms of Spain is that it's the mission or the ambition or the project of Christians as they are in conflict against Islamic rulers of the southern part of the peninsula.
So it's very much embedded with the concept of a Christian expansion and of a Christian reconquest of a territory that was stolen from them by a particular group, by the Muslims.
So it changes from being a straightforward geopolitical experience to something that is about religion. And so that becomes really something that's about identity. And that becomes super problematic, right, over time, because that religious identity justifies all kinds of things.
Right. So where did this idea come from? Where did the idea of characterizing the conflict between Muslims and Christians in medieval Iberia as a reconquista, as a reconquest, where did this develop?
Yeah, I'm going to point to three different developments that I think you could talk about. First of all, starting in maybe the 10th century, so already a couple hundred years after the inauguration of Islamic rule in Spain, we have these Christian narratives, these medieval chronicles that make a big deal about that connection back to the early Visigoths, right? Mm-hmm. And specifically the Chronicle of Alfonso III is the one.
Which we've read. Yeah, we read part of that.
Yeah. And so that lays out a vision of the connection between the rulers of the current moment, Alfonso III and his group, back to the Visigoths, and legitimates his rule in terms of that lineage. And thus also legitimates his actions, right? In terms of that lineage. And so that lineage becomes this sort of rationale for what they're doing. The 10th century is not the time to be looking at major Christian activity or success vis-a-vis Islam in the South, but you're starting to see quite a bit of Islamic incursion into the Christian kingdoms of the North, most famously with this guy Al-Mansur of the late 10th century. And so you're building up this kind of narrative tension and distinction between these different groups. And it's extremely complicated, right?
Because
students should know that Al-Mansur, for example, had Christians in his army. It's just not straightforward at all. It's also important to recognize that those medieval chronicles are written by clerics. Right? Yeah. They're written by religious men who have that worldview. The history that they're writing is fitting into a larger history of the world that is dictated by God and that is, in fact, after the coming of Christ for these guys, it's a Christian history, right? So they're putting all this stuff in there and that's shaping this story. So that's the first place I would look. And and I don't think those chronicles use the term reconquest or anything like that, but we can start to see the development of a narrative that justifies Christian expansion in light of Christian past. And then the second thing that becomes really important in this actually comes from the outside of Iberia, which is the introduction of crusading ideology in Iberia. And people who study the Crusades argue about whether you should even include Spain in that discussion. Yeah. It's only about Jerusalem. But I think that you can see really clearly the preaching of the Crusade, for example, for people who come from France and go to Iberia and fight and earn the crusading indulgence. And that way of thinking about what they're doing encourages the thinking of medieval people in terms of justifying what they're doing and linking it to this Christian Islamic divide. And when you look at the outcomes of some of the, they're not crusading battles necessarily, but they're battles with crusaders and crusading ideology associated with them. So the one I know the best is the career of Fernando III. And so he takes Cordoba and he takes Sevilla. And when he does this, his activities always involve taking the mosque and turning it into a church. But there's this kind of notion that site is somehow the location of a previous Christian site. And one of the first things that these guys do is they establish what they say is reestablish the diocese, the bishop's regime. And when they do that, they're not just establishing a new diocese. They're saying, we believe that there was something here before, and now we're restoring it.
Restoring it to the Visigothic past, presumably.
Yeah, and even back to the Romans. But really, the Reconquista as a concept that is applied, you know, consistently and coherently to Iberian history really comes from the modern period. You can see this in the 19th century. And you can see this kind of thing happening across Europe, right? This is a trend where you have historians and literary people and politicians looking back to some past, some ideal type of a thing. And for example, in England, you have people like Sir Walter Scott writing Ivanhoe and these great narratives, great stories, but they're really dangerous in a lot of ways because they imply that Anglo-Saxons have always been here and that they are the right, pure, true leaders of this world. And the same thing's happening in Iberia. So in Spain in the 19th century, there's a great deal of political conflict between liberals and then others who are royalists who want to see the strong monarchy and they associate that strong monarchy with the church. And in that context, there's this elaboration amongst historians of looking back to Iberia and thinking about their identity and seeing the identity as being shaped by the strong, powerful drive of Christian kings who are restoring something. So I think that that's really where the Reconquista as a coherent concept is introduced.
So very much in the context of nationalism, but if nationalism that's particular to Spain at that time, that's intricately connected with the Catholic Church and the idea of Spanish kings as the defender of Catholicism in this way. Absolutely. We've looked at a number of portraits in the course of our class. I've been particularly looking at how the 19th century Spanish artists represent medieval kings, because there's so many portraits that are done all the way back to the Visigoths, actually. And so we've been looking at these different portraits that were painted in the 19th century of these various Spanish kings, representing them in very particular ways, but also particular moments of medieval Spanish history, done very much in the way of Ivanhoe, in these very romanticized, nationalistic ways of representing this past.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. Mm. And it's still embraced. And people reproduce these paintings and say, today let's celebrate this battle or that battle. And this is the evidence that they have for how glorious it was. This goes back to the 19th century. So what you really have is evidence for how 19th century people imagined the past.
So then what are some of the problems that are embedded in the use of this term to describe this conflict? And I think we've hinted at some of them already, but why is it so problematic? What are the implications of using it?
So there are a couple. Mm-hmm. And I think that to start with, the least political problem, but also a really important one, is that when we look at nearly 800 years of Spanish history, there are multiple kingdoms, right?
Yes.
They changed in shape. Yeah. There are multiple regimes and dynasties, and that includes in Al-Andalus. There's more than one invasion of Muslims that come in. And so it's an extremely complicated period of history, and it's a very long period of history, and it's super complicated. And the moment when you start to refer to it as a thing, right? Then you're wiping out all kinds of important features of that history. You are erasing history. You're saying it doesn't matter that there were all these regimes with these various legal codes and that they were in conflict with each other as much as they were. Christians were fighting Christians as much as they were fighting Muslims, if you care about fighting, right? If you don't care about fighting, you're saying there's nothing else worth studying here. We're not looking at economies. We're not looking at art. We're not looking at religious theology necessarily, right? There's all kinds of things that are just getting wiped out by this kind of lumping together of this is the history of medieval Spain. So that's my first caution. And then the second one, and I think this is the one that is getting the most attention right now and is really important, and the reason why we really do have to watch ourselves, I think, are the political implications of this. And I'm going to divide that into two. So the first thing here is that as historians, I think it's really important that we strive. We're never going to be perfect at it, but that we strive for some kind of objectivity. And the word Reconquista is embedded with righteousness, right?
Yes.
It's basically saying that the people who proceeded here were about something that they were entitled to do. And as historians, we really can't allow that to happen. We can get ourselves caught up into these justifications, I think. And then the second part is This, it's hard for me to articulate this, but it's really important that we all work through this a little bit, that this narrative of a righteous, justified, legitimated 800-year-long adventure that was coherent and agreed upon, that this is really emphasizing the difference between and the inherent conflict between, and ultimately the idea that there's a lesser and a greater relationship between Christianity and Islam. So what we have is the justification of Christians to conquer and drive out Muslims. And I would not at all argue that many Christian people in the Middle Ages thought that way. I have chronicles where king goes to his mother and says, I want to go beat that apostate Muhammad. But rather what this has is it implies that Christians now are justified mm-hmm. in that kind of behavior. It reinforces that conflict, and it reinforces, this is something in the study of Crusades as well, this notion of the clash of civilizations. You have these two groups of people who are never going to be able to get along, and one must win. It's a zero-sum game. And this, many of us find this kind of thinking offensive, mm-hmm. but also just really dangerous, because this way of thinking does appeal to some people, especially people who are maybe afraid, right, of difference, and people who feel that they have been, and this would be a very medieval way of thinking, in some way disinherited, or some way that their own legitimacy is lessened in some way. Mm-hmm. So when they see a narrative of this great, victorious, justified Christianity over Islam, they latch on to that. And so we know that's not good history, but we can also see that it's potentially a dangerous position to take.
I think the essentializing of all of medieval Spain's history of this 800-year-long period as being this conflict between these two groups that are all the Christians are the same and all the Muslims are the same removes all the complexities that make actually the story of what happens across medieval Spain interesting. It's those nuances and complexities and confusing parts and everyone being named Alfonso and all that stuff. Like, those are the things that make it interesting to think about how these different people are battling against each other and how the alliances shift and change over time. And to me, that's what I find fascinating about medieval Spanish history is the complexities. And this term just erases all of that.
Exactly. And trying to find a way around the term doesn't mean that you don't get to study battles and wars and weapons and soldiery and ideology, extremely important stuff. But your study of that is not done any good service by lumping it all into a box and saying that was this thing. And that's really what this term is doing. Okay. When I teach this class, that's the place I go to, because I don't necessarily want to get into big ideological arguments about the contemporary political world, but that is also there. And it's important to recognize. I think that we can always appeal to precision and objectivity, and even recognizing that things are really messy and that you can't accurately describe things simply. That's maybe a first step in how to deal with this.
And this leads into my next question about the weaponization. Because in our discussion of convivencia that I had with Alexandra and Sarah, we spent some time talking about how this term has been weaponized as a particular tool, convivencia. And we talked about how it's both been used to present a picture of interfaith relationships in Spain that was harmonious and where there wasn't any conflict and they were all together, and how problematic that is, but also how it's been used by certain right-wing groups and writers to argue that this is a fake, and so this didn't happen, and so we need to present a more accurate picture that. But I think Reconquista has also equally been weaponized, perhaps even more and more dangerously, as you've highlighted here. So why do you think the use of this term Reconquista becomes so appealing for, white supremacist groups, for example, or particular types of far right groups, which I know in Spain happens, but also I think elsewhere?
Right. That's a really hard question. I do think that there is a historic appeal, okay, to this kind of glorious sense of this righteous conflict where all the battles are won by the right people. And you could go back to the 1960s and look at the Charlton Heston as El Cid. My favorite part of the movie is at the very end. It's just so crazy, because if you know the story of the Cid, it's just, this did not happen. He's dressed as a Turk.
Yes.
This just really funny because nobody cares that they're what a Muslim might have actually looked like. And I think that there's a lot of attachment to that kind of glory. But I think that in terms of the justification, it's something I don't thoroughly understand. I consider myself to be quite knowledgeable about Catholicism, mm-hmm. both medieval and modern. And I know a lot about Spain, but there is a powerful attachment to a very particular kind of conservative Catholicism that drives people's attachment to and justification the reconquest as a concept mm-hmm. and its own justification. So something that your students might be interested in is looking into Isabel. This is the queen in 1492, the efforts to sanctify her. I don't know where that is right now, but maybe she's been beatified. But I think there's a great deal of interest in looking at her as the engine of bringing Christianity to the new world. And this, despite the fact that millions of people were enslaved and killed by disease, and you know, it's really awful and very not very Christian. And even she had her doubts about some of it. So I think that there's a modern historic attachment to that very particular brand of Catholicism. Even for people who are not necessarily devout, it's part of their Spanish identity. And so I think that, I don't know if I would use the phrase weaponized, although I don't think that's wrong, but very much politicized. We are bringing in an identity, and you're saying your identity is attached to this historical moment that we think is true, and that not only we think is true, but we think was justified, we think was right. That if the reconquest hadn't happened, everybody in Scandinavia would be a Muslim. You're like, that's not how history works, but that's the way in which this is put rhetorically that allows people to even recognize some of the horrors of war and the horrors of racism and still justify it.
Mm-hmm. I always remind my students, we don't know all the factors that would have taken place. So we don't know what would have happened, right? Like,
it might not come out the way you planned.
And the fact that the Muslim kingdoms in the south never really bothered to conquer all of Iberia in the first place, that belies the idea of them pushing all the way up to Scandinavia.
The other thing I'll say, what I'm thinking there a little bit, which is this role of race, and you're probably going to talk about this. You'll probably talk about this with Mark Meyerson a little bit, maybe. But I think that currently medievalists understand that race was something that was real, but was not engaged with in the same way or understood in the same way in the medieval period. But as far as this modern attachment to weaponization of the reconquest is concerned, there has been a leap to racialization. You start to see, again, this is the appeal to this notion of difference in the clash of civilizations, or Muslims versus Christians, white people versus brown people, that glorious past is used to justify those distinctions now. And it doesn't help that there are similar kinds of rhetoric that happen, say, for example, in Al-Qaeda, that there's an attachment to that past and that division that is amped up. In that extreme rhetoric of other groups. So it doesn't help that there's been these aggravations to this conflict
that happened on both sides in this reconstruction. So how do we then talk about this conflict? What language do we use to characterize these, which is really a series of wars? It's not and that's the problem of Reconquista. It applies that there's this constant war that's happening, that's the same people involved, when really it's not. So there how do we then talk plan. About it?
There's a battle plan. So I struggle with this too, absolutely, because first of all, the books haven't caught up to this. So when you're reading, I've got a book right here now, The Reconquest Kings of Portugal. First of all, when I'm talking about what the Christians are doing, so as they begin to organize themselves into pretty powerful kingdoms, as they get financing, and as they turn their attention to expansion, I talk about expansion and I talk about conquest. And so I just try to replace that reconquest with conquest. And that's challenging because it really does suggest, again, that now the Christians are taking something that belongs to somebody else.
Yes.
And get into this really interesting conversation sometimes, it's really, it comes down to the philosophy of history. How far back do you get to go? What's the statute of limitations on thinking about possession? And what does possession even mean to these people? Yeah. One of the really interesting things about medieval Iberia doesn't last for a long time, for maybe 100 years or so, though. There's this big swath of no man's land. And so what does that mean in terms of thinking about people building these fortifications and expanding? I think that this way of understanding Christian growing hegemony right, is helpful in thinking about it as expansion, conquest. We don't see, you do in Aragon, peace treaties and agreements between and others. And I think that's less a characteristic of Castilian politics. Mm-hmm. And even again, there you've got different ways of managing the relationships between these different polities. And I that's one thing I think that I do, which I try to emphasize these different ways of thinking about these political and military growths. And I think that you can talk about invasion, you can talk about conquest, you can talk about crusade, and they can all be precise in specific contexts. So it's hard as a teacher, it's hard as a student, to be really intentional about the words that you're using and not cavalier with these things, because they're loaded. And once you accept that, then it's easier. And I think that's another interesting thing, to go back to the politics, is that as I see people defend the use of Reconquista, I don't ever see anybody say, oh, it doesn't mean anything, or it's just easy, or it's just the way we want to talk about it, or it's the way we've always talked about it. No, they're defending Reconquista. They're defending the concept. So we're at a point now where we have to be very mindful about the words we're using and understand that if we're using them, they're going to be interpreted in a certain way. I also think you can talk about war and military conflict. And that reminds us too, that there's lots of other stuff going on, that it's not one big unified plan, but there's trade and expansion and there's exploration and settlement and the trade in captives, slave trade. There's all these things that are happening where people are working together and against each other.
And all of that, I think, is erased if we just simply use this one term to talk about it. I think seeing this is an unbroken history from the Muslim invasion in 711 to the conquest of Granada in 1492, it just doesn't work, right?
And I think, you know, you also just touched on something I think is really interesting and that I don't think we appreciate enough, which is the relationships between various mostly Christian rulers in Iberia and other rulers across the Mediterranean and Northern Europe and into Scandinavia, and their attachments to the Holy Roman Empire, and all these kinds of things are happening as part of the story. And the same goes for their relationships to Northern Africa and Egypt. And you're just thinking about Morocco, you're thinking about the ways in which Iberia, we tend to look at it as a really coherent, understandably, this giant peninsula that's kind of hanging out there and it's something unto itself. But in fact, it's super engaged with all kinds of other people and groups that are happening. And again, I think Reconquista tends to keep everything internal. Just that.
So both of us are gender historians. And one of the things I always like to talk to my students about is the role of women in medieval Spanish history, particularly in frontier society. I think partially because my introduction into medieval Spanish gender history came from Heath Dillard and her book, Daughters of the Reconquest, which I think has inspired many of us who are now medieval Spanish gender historians. So given your own research, can you talk about the role of women in these series of conflicts that happen, in how medieval Spain is shaped by this warfare?
My mind would immediately first go to the Heath Dillard and the Fueros and all that, because it lays everything out there. But that work is related to a long history of law codes. And legal frameworks for landholding and inheritance and the rights of not just women, but anybody in a family to claim land or property. And so as far as the expansion of Christian rulers goes, they take a great interest in having women be part of the, there's something called the repartimientos, right? The divisions of essentially booty. When kings conquered land, they distributed it to their followers. And those followers included people all the way down the scale. Somebody who was a worker in the court, might get a little something from the king as a reward. His interest is in settling that land and just in rewarding his followers. And he does that as much to women. Mm-hmm. Super interesting to read. These things exist for Castile, they exist for Aragon. And you can read them and see how there are lots of women who are getting something from this settlement. And then the law codes explain how they should be protected and what their rights are in terms of this settlement. And the law codes also serve to encourage women to come and settle, to marry men and give them some privileges within the marriage and all this kind of stuff, because of course they want to reproduce society down there. That's all after the fact. That's after the fact of the violence. And before that, what I know the best are the queens, royal women, and their roles. And I would say the following. They have a couple of roles. First of all, there are queens who are military leaders. Mm-hmm. And what we don't see, and this is just because of the flimsy evidence that we have, we don't see how they are thinking about what they're doing in terms of conflict against Islam. Mm-hmm. Okay. We can see that the Queen of Portugal, Teresa, has to defend Coimbra, and there's a Muslim invasion, and the city gets burned down, and she does X, Y, or Z. We can see her activity. We can't see how she's characterizing this conflict. My suspicion is that she is thinking about it just in terms of territory that she wants to control, like a game of Risk or something like that. And that's her father would have done, or her nephew over in Leon. So that's how I think that the women, the military aspect of it, that's how I think they're thinking about it. They also are really important in the case of Berengela, who's the mother of San Fernando. She is recorded really clearly as helping him. So he goes to south of Toledo, he goes down to Cordoba to fight, and he needs somebody to rule back home. Mm-hmm. And the women do this. And this is, we see this phenomenon across medieval Europe, actually. Yeah. So she's helping keep the peace at home and govern at home. But she's also sending him supplies and sending him wagon trains full of weapons and men and food and things like that. So women have a role to play in all of this. And they also have a role to play in the complexity of what we're talking about. They're earlier on, let's say in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, there's a fair amount of evidence of Christian daughters being sent to the caliph's court to join his harem.
And then, we've talked about that a little bit.
It's a peace deal or some kind of gift giving that's happening there. There's a woman who comes from the Islamic court, from the court of Cordoba, Zaida, who becomes Elizabeth, apparently. She's first the concubine and probably becomes the wife. We don't even really know because they didn't care that much to tell us. Becomes the wife of Alfonso VI and bears his only son, who does not survive him, but nonetheless is a really important contribution to the dynasty there. So there's this kind of exchange in traffic in women that is part of this story that seems to really challenge the religious ideology. It's sad, but when you read the chronicles and the texts closely enough, the charters that I read a lot, you see a tremendous amount of evidence of the costs of warfare and for ordinary people. And it's always not just people, but specifically numbered, named men, women, and children. And you see once in a while women's names in documents. They're enslaved people, and almost certainly they've been enslaved as a consequence of war. So there's a really dark and sad understory to the whole thing. It's not about glorious victory in battles. It's also about the consequences for ordinary people who are living in this time. And it was brutal in a lot of ways. And I think that there were plenty of times of peace and collaboration. People lived in neighborhoods together. I see in parts of Portugal, lots of communities that are, it seems like they're Mozart Arab, right? So they're Christians, but they speak Arabic and they have Arabic names and they probably eat like Muslims and basically live like them. But it's not always clear, are they Muslims or are they Christians? There's these people and they're living their lives and there's evidence for them. And I think that the women had a really profound varieties of experience and profound experience of both these conflicts, and they might be more concerned about the crops, or they might be more concerned about giving birth, or they might be really concerned about their man who's gone off to fight the Muslims. There's just a lot going on there, but they're playing a role all the time.
And I think one of the implications of the idea of Reconquista is all of that gets ignored, because Reconquista is conceptualized as this masculine endeavor of reconquering Spain from the Muslims by these Christian kings and their warriors.
Yeah.
And the role of women in all of that is not mentioned.
There is a role for religious women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And when we want to think about conflict between religious groups, right, we can bear in mind that these stories and these plans and these vows and all these things that are happening are mostly happening, again, in the male world. There are women associated with some of the military orders. So that's an interesting problem. But there's exceptions. I guess I would look at Las Huelgas and Burgos. Yeah. I've talked about it as a crusade document. Yeah. But for the most part, there's all these ways that women are living out every aspect of life, from the highest levels of society to the most idealized types as nuns. Reconquista is not explaining what their stories were.
That's very true. So if you had to briefly sum up what students should do when they're confronted with this term Reconquista in their research, how should they think about it? What's the best advice you would give them?
That's a great question. I think I would tell them just to stop and look at the context of how the word is being used. And now they can say, at the very least, that it's not neutral. This is not neutral. Maybe it's just habitual. Maybe the historian they're reading was writing in, let's say, 1978, and they just kind of habitually use this term. But even that habit is emerging out of a longer modern history of how to think about Spain. And so they're going to understand that it's not neutral. And then they can start to understand how it's being used, why it's being chosen. What is this word meaning here? And I think it's important to be really generous in terms of the historians that they're reading and the texts that they're reading. Don't assume that everybody's out to say something terrible of the past.
Yeah.
But rather do understand still that they're accountable and that this word has some meaning and that they shouldn't replicate it. So that would be this thing I would say, like when you read other terms in the past that we no longer use, when you think about all women as housewives or something, you wouldn't do that. So just because somebody else in the past assumed that this was an okay term to use, that doesn't mean you can use it now. You got to recognize it.